We're going to go on to our second case, and that is Appeal 11-14-73, Kate Hart v. Terrell. Good morning, Mr. Rosenwein.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Tom Rosenwein on behalf of Loretta Capehart, who's the appellant here and the plaintiff below. We're asking this Court to reverse the entry of summary judgment that was entered by the district court below and to remand this case for a trial on Professor Capehart's claim of First Amendment violation. Before I get to the issues that are raised in the main appeal, I think I do want to address the issue of this Court's jurisdiction, since that was raised by motion. As you may recall, the motion filed was dismissed for a lack of appellate jurisdiction. I'm sorry, Judge. I'd like to address the initial question of whether or not there's appellate jurisdiction in this Court.
Excuse me, are you comfortable? We can always raise this, you know, and you're not using up any time while I speak.
Oh, okay, well, that would be nice if you could do that. That'd be great.
Yeah, it's pretty low, isn't it?
You first argue with the short.
Yeah.
Okay. I see how it goes.
Are you going to obscure your face? What are you doing?
Well, that might not be a bad idea, given my face. But let me address the question of the motion to dismiss for lack of appellate jurisdiction, if I may start with that, Your Honor. The claim was made that we had somehow given up our claim for injunctive relief in the court below, and that's simply not true. We did not do that, and there's been no indication, there was no pointing in the motion to any specific language where we gave up on our injunctive relief. What we did say was, with regard to one specific element of the injunctive relief that we're seeking, that my client be appointed as chair of her department. What we indicated was we're not seeking to oust anybody from their current position. In other words, the kind of relief that we would be seeking by way of injunction on that particular point would be that when there is an opening for the chair of the department, and then if there is a vote that elects Professor Capehart to be the chair, that the institution honor that vote. And as you know from the record, it's a custom and practice that the person who is elected by the members of the department is, in fact, made the chair. And that was the only thing that we said that related to the injunctive relief.
Was this supposed to be a ruling that any time that recommending body makes a recommendation that's ironclad and that applies to everybody, not just your client?
It's not ironclad, Your Honor. The vote does go to the administration.
That's what you want to anticipate and enforce.
That's right. That's right.
That would apply to everybody, wouldn't it?
Well, we're asking that in this particular case.
No, in every case, because this case isn't before us. It's all in anticipation of what might happen in the future.
Well, that's correct. There's an anticipation of what may happen. If we know that there's going to be openings, there have been some four openings while my client has been there in the chairship. So the question is, once that happens, if there is a vote in favor of my client, that the administration honor that vote.
Those are a lot of contingencies. That an opening occurs, your client's still there, the vote goes in her favor, and so forth. That doesn't sound like the stuff that injunctive relief is made of.
Well, I think it does comply with Rule 65, Your Honor. There's really just one condition that would be part of what an injunctive order would be in that regard, and that is simply that if the department votes in her favor, that vote be honored. We know that there's going to be openings. There's not lifetime appointments in being chairs of departments at this institution. So that's going to be an opening. And the only condition would be that if she is elected by her colleagues to be the chair, that that be honored.
Could you briefly describe for me the entirety of the injunctive relief you seek in this suit, or the entire relief that you seek in this suit?
Yes, there were three aspects of that, Your Honor. One was injunctive relief that would prevent the defendants and those in concert with them from silencing my client with regard to the specific issues that are raised in this case, her speech with regard to free speech for students and not arresting students when they engage in peaceful protests, her speech relating to anti-war concerns. These are all public concern issues. The second part would be that she not be retaliated against, that they be enjoined from retaliating.
What retaliatory acts could the university take against her, you know, given that she already has tenure? She has the Excellence Award and she has tenure.
Well, the Excellence Award is awarded each year. So they could certainly prevent her, retaliate against her from giving her Excellence Awards in the future. Similarly, when there is an opening, they could deny her, if she's voted by the faculty, they could deny her the opportunity to serve as that chair.
So your relief would prohibit them from denying her any future award or any future dean or chairship or promotion?
That's correct, if based on her speech. So it's not requiring them to do something that would not ordinarily occur. It only forbids them from using her speech and the speech on particular issues, from using that as a basis for denying her benefits. Benefits could include becoming a full professor, for example.
Well, she got the award for getting the book published, I assume.
She did. After this case was filed, then that year they did.
Okay,
they did give her that award.
So, well, I don't know what's in the book, but apparently somebody either liked it or it didn't matter. I don't know how you get the award. So she writes another book, and they don't like it. So it doesn't deserve the award, but we've already got a mandate to give her the award anyway.
Well, no. The mandate would relate to
her speech.
Yes. You can't deny it on the basis of her speech.
No, but what if the book's not any good?
If the book's not any good, they don't have to give her the award.
It's on her speech.
Pardon me?
It's based on what she wrote.
No. The speech that we're talking about is the, and this is what the case is about. She engaged in.
You're talking about she going, the socialist kids go out and make a demonstration and she supports them. That's the speech. And you don't want to reflect on whether or not she gets an award for her book.
That's more or less correct. The two instances where there was retaliation, they actually were not socialist club events. She met two students at the first one on campus who asked her if she would help them with this leafleting, and she agreed to do so. The second incident was an activity of the anti-war club. A couple of members of that club were socialist club members also, but that was not a socialist club activity. She was not even present.
That's the speech you're referring to.
So that's that. Yes. Well, the speech that I'm referring to is the protest, the leafleting against the war that took place, and her speech on behalf of students who she believed were peacefully protesting a CIA recruitment event on campus and who were arrested while in the course of a peaceful protest. So that was really her speech trying to defend free speech.
What harm did she suffer from the delay in obtaining the Excellence Award? I mean, I understand that the university granted the award only after she initiated litigation, but what harm in particular was caused by the delay?
There is a monetary amount that is awarded for these for the teacher excellence or the faculty excellence award. It's $1,000 for receiving that award. So, when she did not receive it, she was denied $1,000.
But eventually, she did receive it. You're not saying, you know, the interest on the $1,000, or what are you saying?
No. These are awarded each year, and as you may know from the affidavit of her colleague, Professor Milovanovich, He's received some 16 or 18 of these awards.
So there's more than one a year.
There, yes. Well, there's several faculty members who get the awards, and they're awarded each year. And a professor can get them each year. You can get an excellence award each year.
Or can she? Can she get two a year, four a year?
No, you get one a year.
Right.
You get one
so
a year.
So what I'm trying to figure out is there was a delay in her receiving the $1,000 and the award, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it a delay, Your Honor. She did not receive the award for that particular year. She didn't get that $1,000.
But she got it eventually.
She got an award for a different year.
But based on the same conduct for which she wanted it in 07, correct?
Right.
That book was recognized, but she had more than just the book. There's other, simply writing
the
book.
She had the other stuff in 07 as well, in addition to the book?
She had additional material, that's right.
So she got awarded for it in 08, the same conduct, correct? The book and the other thing.
No, it was different work in the second year when she did get the award.
So it didn't relate to the book?
It related to the book in part. It also related to other research that she did.
Yeah. Did you give me the third type of relief that you're seeking?
No, because I interrupted.
That's all right. Can you tell me what the third?
The first was to prevent them from silencing her.
Right.
Second was to prevent them from
retaliating
against her. The third was to have a mandatory injunction that if she is elected by her colleagues to be chair or program coordinator, depending, that be honored by the administration. She be appointed to that position.
Even if it's, say it's just a 5-4 vote. Close vote on this recommendation.
No, actually.
I'm being hypothetical.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, because that's where we are. So let's say, I don't know how many are in the faculty, but let's say it's a 5-4 vote. Remember that one group she was in where they couldn't even talk to each other. So it's a 5-4 vote. Then it goes up to this next level where that's 5-4 means she's in, even if they may look at this from the other side and say, I don't think so.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's just like
that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, it's like a Supreme Court decision. 5-4, but the five wins.
Okay.
Exactly.
What if the justice section is merged with another or abolished or something like that? Then what happens to our injunction?
Right. If it's merged, that's why we ask that there also be, she either be appointed as chair if there's a vote or a program coordinator. If it's merged with another department, then the way the system works is that the program gets a coordinator to run that particular program rather than a chair. There's a chair of the whole combined department, and then there's a program coordinator for that particular group that doesn't elect the chair. So if it does get merged, she would have the opportunity to be the program coordinator. And that was part of our request. What I think this case really represents is an opportunity to review Garcetti and the application of Garcetti in the academic environment. And the judge below both ignored the restriction, the exception in Garcetti for academics, but also failed to apply properly the Garcetti official duties analysis as well. And that's what I think we particularly want this court to focus on. As you may recall, what the judge did was basically make an assumption that because my client was an advisor to a student group, the Socialist Club, and because some members of the Socialist Club engaged in demonstrations, therefore my client's official duties involved demonstrating with students and advocating on behalf of students who were arrested. And that simply is not, there's nothing in the record that indicates that that was an official duty of my client. Indeed, it's a remarkable proposition that a professor at a university, that part of their official duties is to leaflet against a war or to engage in petitions and so forth to protest arresting students when they're engaged in peaceful protests. And the way the judge reached that remarkable proposition was by making this assumption that somehow if you're an advisor, well, then anything that the kids in that group do is part of your duties. And there's simply no basis for that. There's no basis for that in the record. As my client testified, what she does as an advisor is that she helps them get speakers, She herself makes talks to the group. She tries to coordinate with other campuses if there's an event that the group is putting on so they can come to for a forum. Has nothing to do with these kinds of protests. She was not an advisor to the Civil Disobedience Club. She was not an advisor to the Leafletting Club, which might give some basis for the judge's indication. That simply is not in the record. I see that my light is on. I did want to reserve some time, so if I may do that.
We're going to add a minute to Mr. Land so that we can give you a minute that you've used.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Come on up, Mr. Land. I always feel so penurious, you know, a minute, but it's just how it has to be. Okay.
If I may begin, Your Honor, by adjusting to my height ever so slightly. There's no manual down there, but I think that looks good.
I enjoy watching you struggle.
happy to oblige, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Peter Land. I'm here on behalf and representing the official capacity defendants in this case, the President and Provost of Northeastern Illinois University, and Melvin Terrell, who is appearing in his individual capacity. As you know, there are two primary arguments that we have in our response to the appeal. One is our motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction based on the change in remedy that the plaintiff sought at the summary judgment level, and to affirm summary judgment because the speech at issue, most of it is not protected by the First Amendment, and none of the speech led to any retaliation.
You know, there's a very basic issue that I would like to ask you, and it's this. In what sense does Capehart's speech owe its existence to her job? Each instance of speech seems to me involves matters of public interest, and none seems to involve speech that she would engage in only because of her job. And that's really the issue here.
Your Honor, I might begin by addressing what the standard is for determining if the speech is pursuant to someone's job. The speech can be pursuant to an issue of public concern, and here we would agree that the speech was addressing an issue of public concern. But that doesn't answer the question under Garcetti of whether the speech was pursuant to an employee's administrative duties, in particular, as set forth in Rankin by this court and Abkarian, and by the Gorham decision from the Third Circuit as to whether a faculty member, when speaking as part of their administrative duties, is speaking as an employee versus a citizen. So it's not that they have to have a required duty to speak. Dr. Capehart did not have a required duty to speak, but she did speak pursuant to her duties. The simplest example is at the Faculty Council and Student Affairs meeting.
That's circular, Mr. Land. You better explain that.
Well,
last two sentences to me.
Your Honor, if she speaks pursuant to her if she speaks to fulfill her duties, then her speech is pursuant to her duties. The standard set forth in the decisions that I addressed set forth that standard. An example.
The amicus brief really sets out pretty nicely the bind that I believe you're in. If her speech was compelled by her job as a professor, then the courts assign a higher value to academic speech. If it was not part of her job, then her speech is protected in the same manner as any private citizen speaking on a matter of public concern. You never acknowledge that bind because you seem to deny that the courts give heightened importance to academic speech. What value do you suggest we assign to speech that she makes as part of her assigned duties as an academic? In other words, are you contending that academic speech is treated the same as other kinds of speech?
Well, it would depend on what you define as academic speech. The speech here, Your Honor, is not academic speech. It's not, as Garcetti defined it, it's not speech in the classroom teaching, and it's not scholarship. It's pursuant to administrative duties similar to those in Gorham, Rankin, and Abkarian. Here, for instance, she was an elected member of two faculty groups, the Faculty Senate, the Faculty Council, and Student Affairs. Her duties in those roles is to attend meetings and speak on the issues that those groups address. That's what she did. Her speech at the Faculty Council Student Affairs meeting with respect to the student arrests was an issue that that committee needed to discuss. Her job duties as a member of that committee involved her speaking about those issues. So even though they're a matter of public concern, they were still pursuant to her duties, and they're not academic speech in the sense that Garcetti reserved the rule. I might also point out...
Are you distinguishing academic speech and administrative duties? What's the line you're drawing between what academic speech and what she did? Are you defining those as following up on administrative duties?
I am, and I'm following
is that
the rule
what you're
that.
You're defining it as, or something else? Am I administrative duties? Is that
administrative speech pursuant to administrative duties? I'm defining as not being academic speech, and that's based
what you're
on.
Saying she did.
That's right.
Okay, so what she's saying is she's outside of administrative duties. That's what she's saying. At least some of her speech was not in line with administrative duties.
And I don't think the record supports that, Your Honor. She had three administrative roles that she spoke to. I spoke about two of them, being in part of faculty committees. The other is to serve as a faculty advisor, much like the advisor in Gorham, only here she had a specific assignment to advise and serve as an advisor to the students who were members of the Socialist Club. That's what she did when she was speaking to advocate, as she admits she did, on behalf of those students. She was speaking pursuant to her advisory role. And she did admit and identify herself when she spoke as a sponsor of that group. She did admit, and the minutes also reflect, their argument in their briefs indicates that the notes of that meeting where she identified herself as a sponsor are contradicted in some way by the minutes of that meeting. They are not. The minutes indicate that she spoke about the Socialist Club, which she advises. And that phrase comes in the course of discussing what it was that Dr. Capehart said at that meeting.
You know, if we were to find, as the amicus suggests, that Pickering and Connick provided the applicable test, how would your argument change? You know, you didn't address those cases in your brief, so I'm wondering.
If you found that she was not speaking pursuant to her duties, Your Honor, then we're not arguing that the institution took any action against her with respect to her speech. So the fact that her speech was pursuant to a public concern would render it protected. That issue hinges on whether her speech was pursuant to her administrative duties and her duties as a faculty member to serve the university. I might add, Your Honor, that something that wasn't addressed earlier is that in this case, the ultimate issue is whether there was any retaliation for any of her speech. We only argue that two of the three speech examples are not protected. The third was the September 2006 Latino Caucus, Legislative Caucus speech. And there was no retaliation. There is no evidence that the actions they took was in response to her speech whatsoever. Instead, all of the record evidence demonstrates in undisputed fashion that the reorganization of the department and the decisions about leadership of her department were made in response to other actions, other events. It is.
I'm trying to figure out, you know, the two instances that are in dispute. You know, the distribution of leaflets to protest the Iraqi war and the presence of the army recruiters at the job fair, and then advocating on behalf of the two students who were arrested for protesting the CIA a recruitment event. And it's true that she was a faculty advisor for a student club, and some of the students involved in those protests were members of that club. But for me, it is difficult to see how any of that speech owed its existence, are the operative words, to her professional duties. Both instances involve matters of public concern on which millions of private citizens, it seems to me, have spoken. And if these statements were made pursuant to her official duties, then she has a good argument for applying the Pickering-Connick analysis rather than Garcetti, it seems to me, to her speech as a university professor. So help me.
Your Honor, the rule that's set forth in Garcetti is that if the speech is pursuant to official duties, whether it's about an issue of public concern doesn't matter for whether it's protected, because then the individual is speaking pursuant to their job duties as a government employee and not as a citizen. And the reason for that rule is that the government employers need to be able to manage their employees free of fear of litigation about their addressing issues within their employment, even if that relates to speech. So the fact that the speech is about a matter of public concern under the Garcetti rule is rendered irrelevant if the speech is pursuant to their duties.
Well, again, how is that pursuant? How does it owe its existence? Not pursuant to duties. How does it owe its existence? Those are the operative words.
You know, Your Honor, the Gorham case is instructive in this respect. In Gorham, the court decided that the faculty member who opted to advocate on behalf of a student in a disciplinary proceeding without an obligation to do so still was speaking pursuant to a role as an advisor to that student. Here, Dr. Capehart had a specific administrative role to serve as an advisor to these students, the students in the Socialist Club. And in both of those instances, she was advocating on their behalf. The fact that she opted to do it as opposed to being required to do it is not determinative. The question is, was she speaking as an advisor? She admits in their brief that she was at the job fair, that she was not just leafleting, but she was intervening on behalf of those students with respect to communications with university officials. That's serving as an advisor, we would argue. And with respect to the speech where she's advocating on behalf of the arrested students, both of those students were Socialist Club members, and her speech took place in meetings where she had additional duties in addition to the advisor duties, but all of her speech, we contend, Your Honor, was advocating on behalf of members of her club. The fact that she chose to do so on campus in communications with other faculty members or other administrators within the institution doesn't render it not pursuant to her duties.
I want to back up or go forward, I don't know which. Assuming this is not moot, and assuming that somehow or other there some of that speech was outside her administrative duties, don't we still have the two issues, one, the chairmanship, and two, the award? Isn't that the two things that are supposedly retaliation?
Yes.
Those two issues.
Yes.
And so what we'd have to then determine on the merits, whether because of the changes in that group couldn't get along and all that sort of thing, is the reason not for having the chairmanship, and the other is she got the award anyway, and what's the difference? That's all. I guess trying to stay, just focus on those two things. Just make your argument on those, because these others can go on like many pages that all First Amendment cases do.
Sure, Your Honor. And again, in this instance, it's undisputed that the events that led to the changes in the department or leadership, let's focus on the department chair issue, were that the chairperson resigned, that chairperson resigned because of difficulties in getting work done within the Justice Studies program. That's what she told the administration. And that those difficulties had led to a program review process not being complete. Those issues were what led to the decisions to not appoint anyone from within Justice Studies to run that department, but instead to appoint outside leadership. And those instances occurred just prior to the decisions to appoint outside leadership. There is no evidence remotely suggesting that any of Dr. Capehart's speech, in any instance we've talked about, led to those decisions to appoint leadership in that department. With respect to the Faculty Excellence Award, that decision is made by a committee, both in the 2007 year and the 2008 year. That committee, there's no evidence in the record whatsoever that that committee had any knowledge of Dr. Capehart's speech. In the first year, that committee decided that she was not worthy of the award because her book was not yet published. In the second year, that committee did award that award to Dr. Capehart. She contends that Dr. Frank, the provost, retaliated against her because of her speech with respect to the Faculty Excellence Award. But all he did was convey the committee's assessment, which was her book was not published within the appropriate time period in 2007. That's all he did. So there is no retaliation for her speech with respect to the Faculty Excellence Award, nor is there any contention that it was later awarded because of this lawsuit being filed. That committee had no knowledge whatsoever about the lawsuit being filed. At least the record doesn't reflect that it did. You know,
but what about common sense?
Well, Your Honor, we're at the summary judgment stage.
Never mind. Go ahead.
I would want to spend a minute about the subject matter jurisdiction issue, which was a lot of what you talked about earlier. There is no live controversy here. All they're seeking is future injunctive relief that does not take any effort to address past injury. And for that, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, both because the case has become moot, because she has lost standing, because the remedy doesn't seek to address remedy, and because the events she claims may happen in the future are not yet ripe for judicial review.
If you're right on the mootness question, don't we still have to reach the question of whether the district judge abused discretion in declining supplemental jurisdiction on the state law claims? Those were pendent supplemental claims.
Well, Your Honor, then the court wouldn't have had subject matter jurisdiction at all because that's the only federal claim.
But it did at the time.
It did not. Our argument is that the court should remand vacate.
But you argue that it became moot because of the alteration of the request,
which occurred at the summary judgment stage, right, before the summary judgment was entered and before the ruling about supplemental jurisdiction.
Yeah, but in declining to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, the court simply stated the obvious. The federal claims are gone, and it wouldn't keep the state claims. That doesn't seem like the court was exercising any discretion at all. It's always true that the federal claims are gone when the court must decide whether to retain the case. How can we tell whether she abused her discretion when she gave no real reasons for any decision here?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe she did abuse her discretion by not exercising supplemental jurisdiction, and I don't believe that answer would change if the case had been dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Wouldn't it? We don't work in vacuums.
I don't know the reason either, Your Honor, but I believe that she had clear discretion to do so. The one last issue I might address is that with respect to the jurisdictional question, there was an issue about whether the delay of the Faculty Excellence Award somehow related or created an injury. And I just want to point out that the future injunctive relief they're seeking would not do anything to redress that injury, and therefore it doesn't create subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Mr. Land. You're going to have to add yet another minute for Mr. Rosenwein because of...
Thank you, Your Honor.
You only got time to lean over, I think.
I have time to lean over. Okay. Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. You know, we're here on summary judgment, and so there are a lot of issues that are, in fact, in dispute. Let me address the last points that were made. With regard to the Faculty Excellence Award, a committee decides initially who should get those awards and make a recommendation to the provost. The provost has the power then to determine who actually gets the award. And as you know from the record, in this particular case, the faculty members go to the provost if they haven't gotten the award and they have the opportunity to ask why they didn't. And the provost then decides to override the recommendations of the faculty group. And that happened in this case. My client went with one of her colleagues who also didn't get the award, spoke to the provost, and the provost said, okay, Professor Milovanovich, you're right. I think you've done enough research. You do get the award. But Professor Capehart, you don't get the award, even though the book that she had written was a more highly regarded book than the book that Professor Milovanovic had written. So it actually is in the provost's hands as to determine.
Published?
Pardon me?
Was the other one published?
The other one was published, yes, that's right. And also, as indicated in Dr. Milovanovic's affidavit, he served on that committee that recommends. And when books are not published, they're still considered. That still is something that it can be looked at. It may not get quite as much weight, but it still is looked at. So it's not rejected simply because it's in press and hasn't quite come out yet. With regard to the question of retaliation, because of the mechanisms of the university, the first opportunity that the provost had to retaliate against Professor Capehart for her speech that she made, which has been admitted, was public speech, public concern when she spoke at this forum relating to the Latino affairs. The first opportunity he had to retaliate was when she asked him if she would get the faculty award, the Faculty Excellence Award. Before that, he did not have the opportunity. In other words, this is not like a situation in an employment discrimination case where your employee at will, and one would anticipate that as soon as one had engaged in speech, if one was going to retaliate, it would happen right away. We're in an academic environment. She's a tenured professor. There also is a collective bargaining agreement in place. And so there's not the opportunity for the provost to take any action against my client for her speech until she comes to him to request that she get the Faculty Excellence Award. That's when he retaliates, at the very first opportunity. So a reasonable jury could determine that there was causation here. And that's all at the summary judgment stage you have to determine. It's not a question of whether or not it actually was a retaliation, but could a reasonable jury infer from these facts that that was retaliation? And I think that can happen. There are a number of other issues addressed here, but I don't have time.
You can't do it? Thank you so much. Case is taken under advisement. Thanks to everyone.